Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm speaking today with Ed Stein. He's an associate professor at the Cardozo School of Law. He is the author of The Mismeasure of Desire, Science, Theory, and Ethics of Sexual Orientation, also of Without Good Reason, The Rationality Debate in Philosophy and Cognitive Science, and edited The Forms of Desire, Sexual Orientation and Social Constructionist Controversy. Welcome, Mr. Stein.
Thank you very much.
This topic of sexual orientation, let's go to the heart of it, I think. What is it? What does it mean to have a sexual orientation? Is it evidenced by behavior? Is it a matter of desire? Is it a matter of identity?
Well, the concept of sexual orientation is, as you suggest, quite a confusing one. And different people in different contexts use it in different ways. The term can be used to refer to a person's sexual behavior, namely the sex of the people a person has sex with. It can also refer to a person's self-identification, that is, whether a person identifies as a lesbian or a heterosexual. Or it can refer to one's underlying sexual desires and fantasies, that is, the sex of the people a person would like to have sex with, perhaps in some ideal situation. For most people, these three different characteristics may in fact vary over a lifetime, and for some people they may differ. Someone might, for example, self-identify as heterosexual, and have sex with people of the opposite sex, and yet still have fantasies and desires about people of the same sex. I think that most of the scientific and psychological research that gets done on sexual orientation is focusing on the third sense, the idea of one's underlying sexual desires and fantasies. And so when I use the term sexual orientation, typically that's what I'm talking about.
Which is different from what Kinsey was oriented towards. He was an entomologist and focused mostly on behavior.
That's right. Kinsey was focused mostly on behavior. He used the phrase, which sounds a little odd today, of sexual output. Which is a behavior-focused account. And he thought that we should focus on that, and that the terms of sexual orientation were, in fact, not very useful, even though some people now will look back on Kinsey and say, oh, Kinsey showed that a certain percentage of the population is gay, a certain percentage is heterosexual. That's, in fact, exactly opposite to what his own views were about human sexual desires.
He thought we were tabula rasas and would do it pretty much given opportunity.
Roughly. Well, what even that aside, what I would say is he thought that the best way to describe people in terms of their sexual desires is to focus on their actual behaviors. And also, he had this idea that sexual orientation, he wouldn't have used that term, but shouldn't be thought of as a noun, but as an adjective. He said, I don't know how helpful that is in thinking about it, but that people don't come in these different kinds. We could say, oh, this type, that type, gay, straight, but people have all sorts of different kinds of desires, and you can have some more than, you know, some people are going to have had more same-sex sexual behavior than others. And that's what his famous Kinsey scale, in fact, represented, actual behaviors along with fantasies and so forth. I think that Kinsey certainly didn't do a random sample when he was doing his study, and in fact sought out sexual variety in such a way that it's possible that people who engaged in same-sex sexual activity and other non-vanilla sexual activity, let's say, were going to be somewhat overrepresented in his study.
when I was coming up in the 70s, there was a prevalent theory that there were two kinds of people who were gay or bisexual. One was the folks who had more of a social or psychological orientation towards homosexuality or causation, and they were more likely to be bisexual, and those who had a more genetic or biological orientation, and they would be more likely to be exclusively homosexual. Do you think there's any support for that nowadays? I mean, it seems that there are a number of different theories out there and a mounting body of contradictory evidence about genetics, intrauterine chemistry, psychological theories, subcultural influence. Where do you come down on all that?
Well, I'll
I know that your book, you've written a whole book about it, so
right.
it's difficult to summarize.
I'll try to condense it a little bit. It's certainly true that it's become widely accepted today, both in the popular culture and also among scientists doing research on sexual orientation, that people are in general born with their sexual orientation. And I don't deny that many people in our culture feel that they didn't choose their sexual orientation. And from this intuition, I didn't choose my sexual orientation, people infer that they were born with their sexual orientation. Now, this doesn't follow. There are many personality traits that people have that they feel like they didn't choose, but it still developed after their birth. Now, I want to distinguish between this claim that people's sexual orientations aren't inborn from the issue about whether people choose their sexual orientation and whether a sexual orientation can be changed. I think it's basically impossible to change a person's sexual orientation, but this also doesn't mean that people are born with their sexual orientation.
Well, let's take a moment there because
okay.
If you're a social constructionist, broadly.
Broadly.
But if you're arguing that there's something so intrinsic that it's not genetic necessarily, but perhaps early childhood experiences that shaped sexual identity and crystallized at some point, how would you explain something such as these earlier studies we said, which are flawed, but which showed that the prevalence of homosexual desire identity behavior is much more common among college graduates than it is among non-college graduates? So that's a post-childhood experience,
right,
which has...
I didn't say childhood experience. You did.
Yeah, okay. I'm putting words in your mouth.
That is a common view out there.
Yeah.
Here's how I think about how sexual orientation is, and then I'll get back to the specifics of your question, which is a very interesting one. How people develop career interests is also a question of interest and that we could look at in a variety of ways. A lot of different factors play a role into how my interest in certain kinds of things in the arts, sports, philosophy, or whatever might have shaped. Some people might develop those interests quite early on and stick to them. Some people might change interests over time. There will be no doubt differences in patterns that are associated with economic, race, social, educational, and so forth factors. I think that sexual orientations, and by the way, biological and genetic factors also play a role in those, though could well play a role in those kind of things. I mean, it's as a result of certain sorts of biological factors that it's highly unlikely I'll ever be an ice skater. I just don't have the physical coordination. It's very unlikely that I'll be good at something that involves that kind of capacities because it's probably something biological. Or certain body types might be good for certain sorts of professions. So clearly some biological factors do play a role in what career interests might have, although it may be hard to sort of spell all that out in lots of careers. And I think sexual orientation is like that. Childhood experience plays a role. Some biological factors play a role. But in fact, we don't understand how they develop. And there's a lot of social factors that do play a role in that. And in fact, some of them may be come in early adulthood or even later. There are people who begin engaging in same-sex sexual activity quite late in life, and who say, it's not that I always felt I was gay, but came to this later.
Some of the, you've studied the biological research extensively,
right.
And some of these studies have just stuck in my mind. There was a study that found, for instance, that comparing straight women, bisexual women, and gay women, that there was a difference in their inner ear clicking.
Yeah, I saw the inner ear study.
The inner ear clicking study, which you know, men click differently from women, and the lesbians were clicking more like men than the women were, you know, the straight women were. So, and there was a study of forefinger length that was conducted in San Francisco where they correlated the length of the forefinger to the middle finger.
Right, and there's also one, another one, as long as we're doing these sort of odd studies, there's also one on fingerprints.
Oh, really?
In which there's certain kinds of loops that you have in your fingerprints, and some people have more left loops that point to the left, and some people have more loops that point to the right, and there turns out to be a gender difference, or sex difference, and the researchers found that there was a sexual orientation difference, so that, and this is in fact a model that, in a way, all three of these studies fit. It goes something like this. As soon as we find a biological sex difference, men have one characteristic, women have another, we think, oh, maybe homosexuals will have gender atypical characteristics for that. In other words, if men tend to have larger regions of a particular region of the hypothalamus, and women tend to have smaller regions, then gay men will probably have smaller regions, more female typical. That's what's behind almost all of the current scientific research on sexual orientation.
Which is kind of like the early German theories of the third sex, that some gay people were a third gender.
It's a version of those. There's an early strand of theories in thinking about sexual orientation called inversion theories. Basically, say that gay men and lesbians are gender inverts. They have the body of one sex and the brain or soul or sexual core of the other sex. It's this sort of inversion theory. And I think that this idea of the inversion theory is one that's very culturally entrenched for us. We think of gay men as in some way effeminate and lesbians as some way masculine. And this theory, there's actually no good scientific support for it. There are some studies that suggest it, but I think that these studies, in a way, rather than proving the inversion theory, instead assume it, and it appears in the results because it starts out with assuming that. I mean, Simon LeVay, who's did the hypothalamus study, which is perhaps the most widely known study on a scientific study on sexual orientation, he examined a very small region of the human hypothalamus. And his hypothesis was that since the hypothalamus exhibits differences between males and females, it would exhibit the same kind of difference between gay men and lesbians. And so he dissected people's brains and tried to see whether a gay man had female typical, that is, in this case, smaller hypothalamic regions. And he found that they did. But I'm skeptical of this study for various reasons. But in particular, I think that this idea of the inversion hypothesis is built into his study from the start. One thing to note about this hypothesis is even if we accept some of the sort of assumptions about sexual orientation, it's not obvious that it's correct to group gay men and heterosexual women and lesbians and heterosexual men together and to say they're going to have similar whatever, brains, inner ears, or however it works. Instead, it might well be that heterosexual men and heterosexual women might have brain structures in common, and gay men and lesbians might have brain structures in common. It might be that there's a certain kind of brain structure that underlies being attracted to the same sex rather than being attracted to men and being attracted to women. That's the way that we typically tend to divide things up. You're going to be either attracted to men or women, and so gay men and heterosexual women are going to be alike. Lesbians and straight men are going to be alike. But that there's no particular reason for thinking that's right. As I say, it could be heterosexual men and women, they're going to have a similar kind of brain structure or inner ear structure or whatever. If you'd like me to, I could go back to one or two of those particular studies. I mean, those studies, first of all, both the finger length ratio study and the inner ear study, they've only been done once. They haven't been replicated. And the problem is that even if they have been disconfirmed, it's very unlikely we would hear about them, because disconfirmations of theories are much less likely to be published. Several of the more popular theories of scientific studies that have been done, Dean Hamer's genetic theory, which looked at a particular region of the X chromosome and claimed to found a gene for male homosexuality there. That study has been disconfirmed a couple of times, but those disconfirming studies haven't been published because they don't have a positive theory to put forward. In contrast, his own study done by Hamer's lab, which reconfirmed his study, was published. So we often don't see the disconfirming theories. I usually say it's good to see three replications of a study done by independent labs before I start to take it really seriously, not just in research on sexual orientation, but in all sorts of research on human characteristics.
Speaking with Ed Stein, he's an associate professor of law at the Cardozo School of Law and author of The Mismeasure of Desire, The Science, Theory, and Ethics of Sexual Orientation. Let's talk for a second about the politics of this field, because for me, coming up in the 70s, the commitment to queer politics was a part of a commitment to a vision of sexual revolution, which was pan-human and not simply a model of subcultural mobilization or subcultural identity. It was that everybody had to get free and everybody had to drop out, tune in, and, you know. It seems like the biological essentialists or psychological essentialists, whichever kind of essentialists they happen to be, they are very much committed to this notion that discovering that you're gay is like discovering that you're black, and that you either are black or you're not, and that once you discover you're black, you have to join the black community and you have to fight for black rights. And that kind of goes against this constructionist, what I see as the constructionist slash sexual revolution vision. Is that a correct way to interpret it, or am I stuck in 20-year-old politics?
Well, it's a complicated question. I mean, first of all, I can't help but interject this thought that race, I would argue at least, and I'm far from being alone here, is not a biological characteristic either. It's also socially constructed. It also is, you know, who counts as white, who counts as black, is highly culturally contingent. In some countries, you know, for example, in South Africa 10 years ago, 20 years ago, you could have your race change by paying a certain amount of money. You could be reclassified from one race to another. Whether we have one or 10 races also, or whether we have two or 10 races, how many races there are, it's quite a socially malleable concept. So I actually argue that some people try to make the analogy that, oh, the biological nature of race helped make the case for equal rights for African Americans. I don't really think the biology played any role in that either. But focusing in on the nub of your question, many gay rights advocates do claim that the recent scientific research into possible biological causes of sexual orientation is helpful to them in their struggle for civil rights. And the thought is that if scientific research demonstrates that sexual orientation are inborn and not chosen, then lesbians and gay men can effectively argue that people shouldn't be punished. They shouldn't be punished for their sexual orientation. Now, I'm not sympathetic with this line of argument. I think it's dangerous and mistaken. It's very risky to link people's basic human rights to the ups and downs of scientific research. I wouldn't want to bet my basic human rights, my right to love the person that I do, to build a family out of that relationship, on scientific research in its very early stage. That's a practical point. But also, this argument focuses on the lack of choice with respect to sexual orientation. But most of what's important about being gay or lesbian is, in fact, a choice. gay people choose to engage in same-sexual behaviors, you could be celibate.
That's the Catholic Church's position.
Right. And there is something right about that. I choose to enter a same-sex relationship. I choose to express my identity as a gay man. If it's acceptable to punish people because of their choices, then it's acceptable to punish me for those choices, for my behavior, for my relationships, and for my identity. So the argument that focuses on lack of choice is basically impotent. It only, if it persuades people, it only works saying people shouldn't be punished for their deep-seated underlying desires, but they could still be punished for acting on them, expressing them in any way. So no one who is already unsympathetic to lesbian and gay rights will be persuaded by biological evidence. So I think, and there's also, if I can go on just a little bit more, there's a further problem, and that is if you come to believe that sexual orientation is biological, and that become sympathetic to gay rights in that way, there's also a flip side. It's likely to lead to a resurgence of attempts to use medical techniques to change a person's sexual orientation, or more likely to prevent the birth of children with a likelihood of becoming homosexual. Not that long ago, doctors and scientists engaged in a wide variety of horribly barbaric and incredibly unsuccessful medical interventions to cure people of homosexuality. Brain surgery, shock therapy, hormone treatment, genital surgery, hypnosis, wrenching psychotherapy. And I feel that the widespread belief that sexual orientations are biologically based will lead to a return to some of these, a contemporary attempt to change or prevent the birth of people with gay or lesbian sexual orientation.
That's actually where I stumbled in your book, because I loved it up until the second to last chapter where you... I'm just take a step back. As a bioethicist, I have taught bioethics. Mm-hmm. As a bioethicist, I have developed a very firm commitment to bodily autonomy and procreative liberty.
Right.
And argue that parents should be, that in general, society will be better off if everyone has that kind of control. And in general, if parents have the ability to determine the kinds of kids that they want to have, you'll have a better fit between kids and their parents, and happier families, all kids will be wanted, and so on and so forth. The argument I would make in response to your kind of moral and political argument against choosing sexual orientation of kids, I'm of course against coercive therapies or harmful therapies,
right,
that would try to do that, but simply, if there was a gay gene,
right,
and you could choose it, my argument would be, why would you want gay kids growing up in families that were so homophobic that they would have gone to the lengths to select against it if they could? Wouldn't you want gay kids growing up in families that were supportive of them and tolerant of them?
Well, I see that point of the argument, but look at it. I think if we maybe we could see a slightly different perspective if we change the argument and imagine what about if we think about a culture, a very sexist culture, where male babies are more highly desired than female babies, like in parts of China and India. And if you say, we're going to give people this complete autonomy, and you're going to say, what will be the large-scale societal results of people choosing to have male and not female children? Now, I'm fairly careful in the book because it's...
That one doesn't work on me either.
That doesn't work on you either.
Yeah.
Maybe I shouldn't put words in your mouth, but you'd say, well, over time, they'll pick boys, and then eventually it'll swing back, and they'll see the need for having girls, and
at the very least, there has to be social catastrophe before I'm willing to have public policy determining the sex ratio of the next generation, telling parents what kind of kids that they can have in order to set as a public policy the sex ratio.
I completely agree with that.
It's even further stretched to argue that we should be determining some ideal percentage of sexual orientation.
I completely agree with both of those.
Yeah.
Here's what I'm saying. I'm saying that we need to think carefully about, here's the simplest claim, and maybe we can agree with this and try to build on that. We should think very carefully about the practical consequences of thinking of using biological research as a way to arguing for gay rights. One possible effect is you'll get lots of people who might try, whether it's on strong biological evidence, who might try to shape the sexual orientation of their kids, and whether it's successful or not. Do we want people who are going to be trying to do that?
No, probably.
Yeah, I mean, so that's the way I would start. I'm also strongly in favor of reproductive liberties and women's control of their bodies and parental freedom from government intervention into reproductive decisions. I'm looking at it from a slightly different perspective of what kind of research do we want to fund? Is it something that we want to be, why are we interested in finding a biological basis for sexual orientation? Why is that? What are the consequences of focusing on that?
In our last minute, the last chapter of your book is about the ethics of doing research in this field at all. Are there people who are actually suggesting that people shouldn't do research into the biological basis of sexual orientation?
There are some. Basically, there are some people who are, and although I'm not really with them quite on this point, here's the best form of their argument. It's like doing research on whether Jews are more greedy, whether Jews have a biological basis for being greedy.
Or blacks are more violent.
Or blacks are more violent or dumb or whatever. It's just the framing of this research is racist, anti-Semitic, or in this case, homophobic. That's, I think, the most sophisticated argument for this view. I don't quite buy it. I think we need to be careful about what scientific research is funded and why, but I think in general, the study of human sexuality has been underfunded and undervalued. It is important to build knowledge in this area, even though I think that most of the scientific research that's being done now is somewhat wrongheaded. I think better research can be done, and so I wouldn't be against doing any of this research. I am not worried about the effects of the scientific research, particularly in places like other parts of the world that are even worse than here in the United States. In Singapore, for example, where they pick up on every slight trend in research on sexuality in this country and try to say, okay, now we're going to start trying to cure homosexuality here, prevent homosexuality here in this way, using Simon LeVay's brain research. I think we have to look also at the international implications of certain kind of research. But I'm not of the view that we shouldn't do any research in this area. But there are some who are.
Professor, it's been fascinating talking to you. I've been speaking with Edward Stein. He's the associate professor at the Cardozo School of Law. His book, The Mismeasure of Desire, The Science, Theory, and Ethics of Sexual Orientation, is available from Oxford University Press. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.